A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a heavy one. He's asking about the voice, the internal voice that sounds like your own but isn't. The one that tells you you're defective, that other people are just being polite, that criticism is hiding behind every neutral expression. He's talking about people who grew up with intensely critical family members, the kind where the shared space was a minefield of unpredictable negative judgment. And he's asking what the path to recovery actually looks like. Not just cutting contact, not just therapy. He wants to know how you extricate that toxic voice from your brain, rebuild trust in other people, and restore a self-image that was never allowed to form in the first place. What's the closest thing to an inner critic exorcism?
This matters right now in a way it wouldn't have mattered 30 years ago. We are living through an era of unprecedented social atomization. Remote work means fewer casual interactions. Fewer casual interactions mean fewer spontaneous reality checks. If you grew up with a critic in your head, and now you spend most of your day alone in an apartment, that voice is the loudest thing in the room. There is no coworker walking by to say, "Hey, nice job on that," and accidentally contradict the critic's narrative. The pandemic-era isolation deepened these patterns for millions of people, and we are only beginning to understand the scale of it.
I want to frame this carefully, because the term inner critic gets thrown around in self-help circles until it means nothing. We're not talking about the voice that says, maybe you should have prepared more for that presentation. That's just having standards. We're talking about a specific internalized representation of a real external critic, usually a parent or primary caregiver, that operates as a parasitic neural pattern. It was installed by someone else. It runs on your hardware, but it is not your software. And I think that distinction is the starting point for everything else.
What exactly is this voice, and why does it feel so real? Let's start with the neuroscience. When we say inner critic in this context, we are not talking about the Freudian superego. We are not talking about generic self-doubt or imposter syndrome, though those can overlap. We are talking about a specific internalized predictive model of social threat. The brain's default mode network. The DMN is a set of brain regions that activates when you're not focused on an external task. It's the network that generates self-referential thoughts. It's the part of your brain that runs the internal monologue. And here's the key. The DMN learns what to say by sampling from your relational history. If your childhood was full of unpredictable, intense criticism, your DMN learned to simulate the critic's voice as a preemptive defense. The logic is brutal but adaptive. If I criticize myself first, it hurts less when they do it. If I can predict the attack, I can brace for it.
It's a survival mechanism that outlives its usefulness, like a smoke alarm that keeps going off after the fire has been out for 20 years.
And what makes it so persistent is that it runs below conscious awareness. The brain is a prediction engine. This is the predictive coding framework. We have covered the foundations of this before, but applied here, it means your brain is constantly generating predictions about what will happen next based on prior experience. If your childhood environment was one where criticism was unpredictable and intense, your brain learned a prior, and I'm using that in the Bayesian sense, that social situations are dangerous until proven otherwise. The prediction runs in subcortical circuits, in the anterior cingulate cortex and the insula, before your prefrontal cortex ever gets a chance to weigh in. This is why you cannot rationalize your way out of it. The threat signal fires faster than conscious thought.
Let me put some numbers on that. There was a 2023 study from Naomi Eisenberger's lab at UCLA that showed social rejection activates the same anterior cingulate cortex and insula pathways as physical pain. Same neural real estate. So when I say chronic criticism is chronic low-grade social pain, I'm being literal. If you grew up in a house where you were criticized daily for 18 years, your brain's threat detection system has been sensitized in the same way a chronic pain patient's nociceptive system gets sensitized. You are walking around with a social pain system that is calibrated to detect threats at a threshold far lower than what most people experience.
That calibration is stubborn. This is where the Bayesian prior framework becomes so useful for understanding what's happening. A person with a healthy childhood has a prior, a baseline expectation, of most people are basically benign. They might get hurt, they might encounter jerks, but the starting assumption is safety. A person from a critical family has a prior of, people are dangerous until proven otherwise. Every neutral interaction is interpreted through this prior. Someone doesn't smile at you in the hallway? The healthy prior says, they're probably distracted. The critic-informed prior says, they're judging you. And here's the part that explains why recovery is slow. Computational psychiatry models from the Wise Lab at University College London suggest it takes approximately 20 to 50 positive disconfirming experiences to meaningfully shift a strong negative prior. 20 to 50. If you have one positive social interaction per day and you are actively logging it, you're looking at 1 to 3 months of deliberate work just to begin moving the needle on a single predictive assumption. And most people are not doing this deliberately. They're just suffering and wondering why they still feel this way after years of knowing logically that they're safe.
Which brings us to the birthday party test. This is a case example that illustrates the mechanism perfectly. Imagine someone with this pattern attends a party where everyone is warm, welcoming, genuinely glad to see them. They spend the entire 3 hours scanning faces for micro-expressions of hidden criticism. They interpret a quick glance away as they're bored of me. They interpret someone checking their phone as, I'm not interesting enough. They go home absolutely exhausted because their brain just ran a full threat detection protocol on a completely safe environment for 3 hours. And then they conclude, see, social situations are draining. I'm not good at them. The conclusion reinforces the prior. The cycle tightens.
The ventromedial prefrontal cortex, the VMPFC, is the brain region that can override the amygdala's threat response. It's the neurological seat of safety signaling. Stephen Porges' polyvagal theory identifies the ventral vagal pathway as the system that enables social engagement and felt safety. The VMPFC can learn to send inhibitory signals to the amygdala, essentially saying, stand down, this is not a threat. But, and this is the critical point, it can only learn to do this through repeated embodied safety experiences, not through cognitive reframing, not through telling yourself, I'm safe, in a mirror. The VMPFC doesn't respond to words. It responds to experiences where your body is in a safe situation and your threat system doesn't fire, over and over, until the prediction model updates. This is why talk therapy alone often doesn't resolve this. You can understand the pattern intellectually for years and still feel the critic's voice in your chest every time you walk into a meeting.
We know why the critic is there. The real question is, how do we get it out? Let me walk through 4 evidence-based paths. And I want to be clear, these are not healing journey metaphors. These are specific protocols with research behind them.
Path 1 is cognitive diffusion. This comes from acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT. The core insight is counterintuitive. You do not try to change the thought. You change your relationship to the thought. The classic technique is the, I notice, I'm having the thought that, instead of, I'm defective, you say to yourself, I notice I'm having the thought that I'm defective. That small linguistic shift does something measurable in the brain. It moves processing from the default mode network, which is self-referential, immersive, believing the thought is reality, to the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is metacognitive, observer mode, watching the thought as a thought. A 2021 fMRI study published in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience showed that 8 weeks of ACT practice reduced DMN reactivity to self-critical thoughts by 34%. That's not a feeling. That's a measurable change in neural activation.
34% in 8 weeks. That's substantial. And the beauty of diffusion is that you're not arguing with the critic. Arguing with the critic is a trap. Every time you engage in a debate with the voice, no, I'm not. Here's evidence that I'm worthwhile. You are strengthening the neural pathway. You're giving it attention. You're treating it as a legitimate interlocutor. Diffusion says, I see you. I hear you. And I'm not taking the bait.
Path 2 is memory reconsolidation. This comes from Bruce Ecker's coherence therapy framework, and it's built on one of the most important neuroscience discoveries of the last 25 years. The foundational study was Nader and colleagues in 2000, published in Nature. They demonstrated that when a memory is reactivated, it enters a labile state, a reconsolidation window of approximately 5 hours, during which the memory can be modified or updated before it restabilizes. This is not repression. This is not just think positive. This is a biological process. The protocol works like this. First, you activate the critic memory. You bring it into conscious awareness, a specific moment when your parent said something that cut deep. Second, you introduce a contradictory experience, what Ecker calls a disconfirming juxtaposition. You immediately recall a memory of someone treating you with genuine warmth, respect, or admiration. The brain encounters two incompatible learnings simultaneously, and during the reconsolidation window, it rewrites the emotional learning attached to the original memory. The factual memory remains, you still remember what was said, but the emotional weight shifts.
It's like opening a file in RAM, editing it, and saving it back. The file path is the same, but the contents have changed.
That's exactly the computing analogy, and repeated pairings weaken the critic's neural weight over time. I want to share a case study that illustrates this. A 34-year-old woman had been no contact with her mother for 6 years. 6 years of zero interaction. But every time she walked into a job interview, she heard her mother's voice telling her she wasn't qualified, she was going to embarrass herself, she should just give up. The critic was running a simulation, not a live feed. She started using the memory reconsolidation protocol. Before each interview, she would briefly recall a specific instance of her mother's criticism and then immediately recall a memory of her mentor's genuine praise, a woman who had told her she was one of the most talented people she'd ever worked with. She did this pairing deliberately, systematically, before every interview for 3 months. After 3 months, the critic's voice during interviews dropped from every single time to occasionally. It didn't vanish, but it lost its grip.
That's the realistic goal here. The neural pathway never fully disappears, but its activation threshold can be raised dramatically. The critic goes from being the default operating system to being an annoying pop-up you can dismiss.
Path 3 is somatic approaches. This draws on Peter Levine's somatic experiencing and Bessel van der Kolk's work on the body keeping the score. The critic does not just live in your thoughts, it lives in your body, a knot in the stomach. These are not metaphors, they are physiological signatures of the threat response that the critic triggers. The somatic approach involves interoceptive exposure, learning to feel the critic's physical signature in your body without reacting to it, without trying to make it go away, without tensing against it. You sit with the tight chest and you breathe into it. You notice the shallow breathing and you let it be shallow. The paradox is that when you stop fighting the physical sensation, the sensation often begins to shift on its own. A 2022 study from the Trauma Research Foundation showed that 12 sessions of somatic experiencing reduced internalized shame scores by 41%. That's a very large effect size for a non-pharmacological intervention.
41% reduction in shame. And shame is the critic's primary fuel. The critic doesn't run on fear. Fear is about something that might happen. Shame is about something you believe you are. The critic says you are defective, and shame is the emotional response that makes that claim feel true. If you can reduce the somatic experience of shame, you starve the critic of its power.
Path 4 is rebuilding trust through micro-experiments. This is the most actionable of the four paths, and I want to spend some extra time on it because a listener could start this tomorrow. Trust is not a feeling. Trust is a skill. It's a set of learned predictions about how other people will respond to vulnerability, and like any skill, it can be rebuilt through graduated practice. The protocol works like this. Step 1. Identify one low-stakes person. This is not your spouse, not your best friend, not your therapist. This is someone like a barista you see regularly or a coworker you barely know. Someone where the cost of a negative response is essentially zero. Step 2. Make one small, vulnerable disclosure. Not, I have deep shame about my fundamental worth as a human being. Something like, I'm having a rough day or I'm a little nervous about this presentation. 1% vulnerability, not 100%. Step 3. Observe their response. Most people, most of the time, will respond with some version of warmth or neutrality. They'll say, oh, that's rough, hope it gets better, or you'll do great. Step 4, log it, write it down. Tuesday, told the barista I was having a rough morning, she said she hoped my day got better. This sounds trivial. It is not trivial. You are accumulating Bayesian evidence. You are feeding your brain data points that contradict the prior. One microexperiment is a single data point. 20 microexperiments is a pattern. 50 microexperiments is a new prior beginning to form.
The logging is not optional. Memory is biased. If you have a critic-informed prior, your brain will preferentially encode negative or ambiguous interactions and discard positive ones. This is called confirmation bias, but it's not a logical error. It's a feature of how predictive processing works. The brain seeks to minimize prediction error. If your prediction is, people are critical, and someone is kind to you, that's a prediction error. The brain can resolve that error in two ways, update the prediction or reinterpret the data. She was just being polite. He didn't really mean it. They're just tolerating me. The trust log short circuits this. You write down what actually happened before your brain has time to rewrite it, and then you review it weekly. You force your brain to confront the accumulated evidence.
This connects back to the 20 to 50 disconfirming experiences threshold from the computational psychiatry models. If you do one microexperiment per day and you log it, you are looking at 1 to 2 months before you start to feel a genuine shift in your baseline expectation of how people will treat you. That's not a long time. That's remarkably fast for rewiring a neural prediction model that was built over years or decades.
Let me bring these four paths together into what I think of as the exorcism metaphor. The prompt asked what the closest thing to an inner critic exorcism would look like. And I think the answer is, it's not a single dramatic event. It's not one breakthrough session where the critic is cast out and you're free forever. It's a systematic process with three phases. Phase 1, recognize the voice as foreign. Every time it speaks, you say, internally or out loud, "That's not mine." That's a recording. This simple reframe activates the prefrontal cortex and reduces amygdala hijack. You are not arguing with the content. You're identifying the source. Phase 2. Refuse to engage in argument with it. This is the diffusion piece. You don't debate the critic. You don't present evidence. You treat it like a radio station you can't turn off but can choose to ignore. Phase 3. Deliberately construct and practice a compassionate internal voice to replace its function. The critic served a purpose. It tried to protect you by anticipating attacks. You can't just remove it without replacing the function. You need to build a new voice, one that says, "You're okay, and that was hard, and you did your best, and other people's opinions are information, not verdicts." At first, this voice will feel fake, like you're lying to yourself. That's normal. You're building a neural pathway that doesn't exist yet. It takes repetition.
This is where I want to address a few misconceptions that show up constantly in coverage of this topic. First, the inner critic is not just low self-esteem. These are different things. Low self-esteem is a global self-evaluation. The inner critic is a specific neural pattern of internalized external criticism. You can have high self-esteem in domains the critic never touched. You can be confident in your professional abilities, proud of your parenting, secure in your friendships, and still hear the critic's voice in one specific area where the original criticism was focused. I've seen people who are objectively high achievers, respected in their fields, who still freeze up in certain situations because the critic owns that territory.
Second misconception, cutting contact with the critic will make the voice go away. The case study we mentioned, 6 years no contact, still hearing the voice in job interviews. That's the reality. No contact removes the external source. It does not automatically rewire the internal prediction model. The voice persists because the brain is running a simulation, not a live feed. You have to do the rewiring work regardless. No contact creates the conditions for healing. It is not the healing itself.
Third, CBT thought. Challenging is the best approach. This one is controversial, but the evidence is accumulating that for deeply internalized critics, cognitive restructuring can actually backfire. Here's why when you challenge the critic's claims, "No, I'm not defective, here's a list of my accomplishments," you are engaging with the critic as if it's making arguments. You're treating it as a legitimate debater. Every round of debate strengthens the neural pathway. You're giving it attention, and attention is what strengthens neural connections. ACT's diffusion approach sidesteps this entirely. You're not saying the critic is wrong. You're saying, "I see you, and I'm not participating."
Fourth misconception. This requires a specific diagnosis. The prompt mentioned narcissistic abuse, and yes, this pattern frequently overlaps with narcissistic abuse dynamics. But the mechanism, predictive coding, internalized threat model, sensitized social pain system, is the same regardless of whether the original critic was a narcissist, a parent with their own unprocessed trauma, a highly anxious caregiver who criticized out of fear, or just a deeply unhappy person who took it out on their kid. The label matters less than the mechanism. Focus on what the brain is doing, not on what diagnosis the abuser might qualify for.
I want to add one more piece that I think is under-discussed, the role of a reality anchor. This is not a therapist, though therapy can be helpful. This is a friend who knows your history and can tell you when your critic is lying. Someone who can say, flat out, that's your mother talking, not reality. The reason this matters is that the critic distorts your perception in real time. You literally cannot see certain things accurately when the critic is active. The reality anchor is an external calibration device. They see what you cannot see in that moment. Finding one person who can serve this function, just one, can dramatically accelerate the recovery process. Because you don't have to rely solely on your own compromised perception. You have an external reference signal.
That's the trust piece again. Letting one person close enough to serve that function is itself a micro-experiment in trust. Which is why the micro-experiments protocol starts with baristas and coworkers, not with intimate confidants. You build the skill of trust in low-stakes environments, and then you gradually extend it to higher-stakes relationships. You don't start by trusting someone with your deepest shame. You start by trusting someone with, I'm having a rough day.
Those are the big-picture approaches. But what can someone actually do starting tomorrow? Here are four concrete actions.
Action 1. The foreign object reframe. Starting right now, when the critic speaks, say to yourself, every single time, that's not mine. That's a recording. Don't argue with the content. Don't evaluate whether it might be true. Just label the source. This is a diffusion technique that you can implement in under a second, and it works because it shifts your brain from immersive mode to observer mode. The critic says, you're going to fail. You say, that's a recording. The critic says, they're all judging you. You say, that's a recording. You're not denying the thought. You're not suppressing it. You're contextualizing it. And context changes everything.
Action 2. Start a trust log. Get a notebook or a notes app. Every day, write down one interaction where someone was neutral or kind to you. The barista smiled. The coworker said thanks. The stranger held the door. Review the log once a week. This is Bayesian updating in practice. You are deliberately accumulating data that contradicts the critic's predictions. The log is not about positive thinking. It's about accurate data collection. Your brain has been systematically oversampling negative data and discarding positive data. The log corrects the sampling bias.
Action 3. Starve the critic of attention. This is the hardest one because arguing with the critic feels productive. It feels like self-defense. But every minute you spend debating the critic is a minute you are strengthening the neural pathway. The critic is a neural pattern that strengthens with use. Think of it like a muscle you're trying to atrophy. You don't atrophy a muscle by using it. You atrophy it by not using it. So when the critic starts its routine, practice not engaging. Not suppressing. The thought is there, you can't unthink it, but not engaging. Let it talk, let it run its script, and do something else. Answer an email, go for a walk. The critic will eventually run out of steam if you stop feeding it.
Action 4. Find your reality anchor. Think of one person in your life who has consistently treated you with respect. One person whose judgment you trust. Tell them, in whatever words work for you, I have this voice in my head that tells me I'm defective, and it came from my family, and sometimes I can't tell when it's lying to me. Can I check in with you when I'm not sure? Most people will say yes. Most people are honored to be asked, and then use them. When the critic is loud, send a text. Hey, my brain is telling me I completely botched that conversation. And let them tell you the truth.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought about what recovery actually looks like. The research suggests that the goal is not to fully extinguish the inner critic. The neural pathway never completely disappears. The goal is to raise its activation threshold so high that it rarely fires. And when it does, it's at low volume, and you recognize it immediately for what it is. Recovery is not becoming someone who never hears the critic. Recovery is becoming someone who hears it and says, with genuine calm, that's interesting, and then moves on with their day.
There's also a future implication here worth noting. AI companions and therapy chatbots are proliferating. There's a risk that people with this pattern will use AI to simulate the critic, asking, "Am I defective?" and getting confirmation from a system that's designed to be agreeable. But there's also an enormous opportunity. AI could be deliberately designed to serve as a reality anchor, a system that consistently disconfirms the critic's predictions, that provides accurate feedback, that helps users log positive interactions and track their Bayesian evidence. The technology is neutral. The design choices will matter enormously.
The critic's voice is not your voice. It's a recording installed by someone else, running on your hardware, consuming your resources. You didn't choose it, you didn't invite it, but you can learn to stop listening to it. Not through willpower, not through positive thinking. Through systematic, evidence-based neural rewiring, it takes time, it takes repetition, it takes the willingness to run micro-experiments in trust when every instinct says not to, but the brain is plastic. The prior can shift, the critic can be starved into silence, and the person you become on the other side of that process, the person who hears the old recording and says, "That's interesting anyway," that person has been there all along, waiting for the noise to quiet down enough to be heard.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1863, a French missionary in the Solomon Islands documented a local custom of settling disputes by having both parties stand in the ocean up to their necks for an entire tidal cycle. The first to exit the water lost the argument. The longest recorded standoff lasted 11 hours and 14 minutes, ending only when a shark was spotted approaching the disputants.
That's right.
That's a dispute resolution mechanism I'm glad didn't catch on internationally. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn. That's interesting.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.